Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Elena Murang. She's a Sape player, Sarawak born, now resides in Kuala Lumpur. We've been talking about the evolution of the Sape. You said you're a teacher now, and you laughed a little when I asked if there are purists in the field, and you said that you're sometimes described as a purist. I understand, though, in some of the material that's been written about you, is that being a woman involved in Sape playing is something extraordinary, that you're one of the few women who does play the Sape. Can you explain what the ritual logic of that is, or what is it culturally that has prevented women from entering into Sape playing until now?
In the past, so pre-1920s, 1930s, the Sape was used for ritual healing. So it was used as a medium to channel spirits. We don't know much about that function now, but from what I heard from, like, actually one of the researchers, there would be certain sapes for certain spirits and certain sapes used for to heal certain ailments. And then the tribes, many of them became Christian in the 1930s to 1960s. So in that period, a lot of our art and music was actually put aside because their function was for ritual. And so because of that, and during that period, like my father's generation, they were the first to go to school and the first to leave the rainforest. So there wasn't a lot of art and music wasn't prioritized, right? So that's why the Sape and a lot of our music skipped my father's generation. Doesn't matter if you were a man or a woman. And then come my generation, we wanted to start reviving and learning about our roots. So my cousins and I, there are seven of us girls, and we approached a Sape master, Matthew Ngao, who lives outside of Kuching. And we just said, "Uncle, can you teach us the Sape?" Like, little did we know, we didn't know why women couldn't touch the Sape or anything. We just wanted to learn this instrument. And only a few years ago, I learned from him that he actually went back home and was starting to question himself, should I teach these girls the Sape? You know, they're girls, they're females, what would the community say about me? And so in the past, it was the men who carried out the rituals. That's why women couldn't even hold the Sape. And he said to himself, you know, there's nobody of that generation learning now. So I want to teach these girls. So we were his first students, actually.
And wonderful.
We were one of the few from our generation to even start learning.
Yeah, you know, there is an amazing pattern in what you're talking about, especially the coming of religions like Christianity and the conflict between that and traditional religions. Mm. I will leave that aside. I do want to ask you, though, you know, are you interested to go back to a time where there was that ritual power? Because the thing that you allude to is that music is healing, or potentially healing, at least seen within the cultural, its cultural context. Is that something you think music is, apart from entertainment, which is what most of us think of when we think of music as having a function? It's, oh, it's entertainment, it's about dancing, but it's not about healing. And healing is a very deep, deep thing, isn't it?
It is a very deep thing. So with the Sape music now, so we don't play, or we don't know of the ritual songs from the past, right? And the Sape we play today is called the human Sape. And
the human Sape?
Yeah, so the Sape used for ritual is called Sape Bali, which is the spirit Sape. So now we play the human Sape, which is for dancing, for entertainment. But I still find it very healing and very meditative, even when I'm playing it. And, you know, I've had people hear the Sape, or people from an audience come to me and say they felt so touched, or, you know, they come in tears or something like that. So I do believe in the healing power of this music. And, you know, if I have been reading about healing music and healing vibrations and things like that. So it is something I would like to explore more. But when you talk about, you know, going back to the old religion and exploring that, and, you know, the healings and the rituals alongside that, that's a very difficult path to go down, because nobody practices that anymore. And I think that if you do go into that, you need to be guided. It's not something that you can just, you know, fall into like that.
Or maybe just invent out of thin air.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you, though, this is a very interesting question of music and the tones that and sounds that music creates and its relationship to our brain, our cognitive functions.
Yeah.
But there's also the question of lyrics. And I understand that you've made an effort to sing in Clubbet and Kenya. I believe that's two languages, right? So Where does that fit in? In the traditional musical form, is there singing? Are there lyrics? Are there songs as such? Or, you know, and how does that work?
So in our cultures, the sape was actually instrumental. And then we had a cappella singing. And it was my teacher, Mathieu, who put the two together. So now we sing with the sape, but actually not many sape players sing with the sape today. There's only a handful of us that do it. And I think it's very important to sing in Kalabe and Kenya. I'm not fluent in the language. And I was doing some research, and it's something like 70 to 80% of languages in Malaysia are either threatened or endangered. So they could die out in my generation or the next generation. So I think music is a very powerful way to keep languages alive. And it's a way that I'm learning the language as well, so it brings me closer to the generation above me, because I'm always messaging them like, hey, what does this mean? How do you say this in this language?
Did you learn Kalabe de Kenya at all at school? Was it some,
no.
There's no formal instruction in the language.
There's no formal instruction. In Sarawak, there's only Bahasa Iban that you can take as an SPM language. So these are languages, even the written form is not standardized. So it's it is a challenge to learn. I didn't grow up speaking it fluently, so I know the basics of it.
Right, and yeah. So often, you know, anthropologists are involved in preserving languages.
Yeah.
Your mother might have done that herself. I'm very interested to know the musical quality of Kalabe in Kenya.
Mm.
And how does that operate? As you as a musician, is there something musical about Kalabe in Kenya as languages?
You know, I've never really thought about it. But I think what I always find really amazing from the reactions of an audience is that they don't understand the words or the lyrics, and it's still, you know, they still feel it. I don't know why, there's no explanation for that. In learning the old Kalabe songs, it's very difficult because it's in a language called Kalabe Dalim or Kalabe Dalam, so it's a very deep, poetic language that, you know, my father's generation and the one above him have debates and discussions over what the meaning actually is of the song. So it's really interesting going through that whole process with them and then coming out with me and my cousins presenting the song in a new way.
So is it you know, are the songs thematically, what do they have to do? Does it do with community life or?
Mm.
Or the afterlife, what is it?
Many of the Kenya songs that I sing are actually about togetherness, being together with my very true friends, and there's always elements of the river, right? We love the river. So that's for the Kenya songs. And then for the Kalabe songs, the ones that I've learned actually from the grand aunties have a very common thread of womanhood. So for example, the song Midang Midang, which I released a music video to last year, that's about a young girl calling out the names of different men who she wants to meet. Like it's a bit like a courtship song. Another song, Rela Kua, is from the point of view of a young girl, and she's singing about all the tasks that she has to do daily and how difficult it is, like going to collect water in bamboo. It's really hot today and the bamboo is really heavy. Or my basket is just too full of padi. Yes, it's really
and that's
interesting.
Not exactly your life, right? So when
it's
you
not, but yeah. There can be similarities, you know. Like you can somehow when you start to dissect it, you can like draw parallels, right?
Okay. Will there be more contemporary motifs in the songs going forward? Are you likely to be singing about just waiting at the bus stop for a bus, or you know the travails of urban life? I mean. Could that enter into the language? And does Kalabe in Kenya have the vocabulary to deal with contemporary life?
You have a lot of good questions. I've never thought of that, you know, because I've always... So we're planning some new songs, and I've written lyrics to them. And they don't have elements of urban life directly, but they're more towards your inner being and your inner spirit, which I think kind of transcends, you know, urban life or rural life. So we have like elements of the wind. There's a song about, you know, meeting someone and you feel like you've known them from a long time ago. So it's more towards that kind of element. We have a warrior song, which is very much about semangat and fire. And but I think in our music videos and in the actual sound of the tracks, we try to be more contemporary. to appeal to like that urban contemporary crowd.
Okay, we'll take a short break. I'm with Elena Murang, and stay tuned for more on Let's Talk.